This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Robert Mueller, part of a long line of special prosecutors in American history. Experts point to the scandal in the Ulysses S. Grant administration in 1875 as the first appointment of a special prosecutor. Since then, there have been several high-profile investigations, including Watergate, Iran-Contra, and Whitewater. What did Robert Mueller learn from these previous investigations? Katie Herriger has studied the role of the special prosecutor in American politics. She's a professor in the Department of Politics and International Affairs at Wake Forest University, and she joins me now. Katie Herriger, welcome. Tell us about this first scandal, and it wasn't the first scandal in American politics, but
no,
the first
certainly
one that generated a special prosecutor, 1875. Tell us about it.
So it involved selling stamps, essentially, that you could use to sell liquor. Right? Yeah. So, but it implicated people who worked in the Grant administration.
These are tax stamps, right? Now
right.
We're taxing alcohol.
Right.
And so that becomes a lucrative business. If you can sell that stamp, you're now legal, and that becomes
right. Right. And, I mean, I think oftentimes we think about the Grant administration as a period where there was a lot of corruption. Yeah. The Department of Justice really didn't exist until after the Civil War. And so it was really just sort of getting its feet, its own feet. You know, we had an attorney general, but we didn't have a Department of Justice. And so it was just gradually developing. But generally the view was that it could not be trusted to
right.
investigate this because there were people implicated in the Grant administration. I mean, and so we got the first special prosecutor.
I want to talk about how that went, but if you think about the theory, it's like, well, why wouldn't we have a Justice Department? Remember, this is a very loose confederation where most of the power and most of the criminal codes were going to be deposited in state capitals. These are going to be the state. There's not a lot of federal criminal law, so there's really no reason to have a big prosecutorial apparatus, right?
Right.
So now we're starting to write more and more laws. We're going to have to start collecting tax revenue on alcohol. There's going to have to be some enforcement. Now we've got a larger department. And then the question is, well, who's going to watch? Who's going to watch the Fox?
Right.
So talk about how this one developed now.
Well, so I think what it's sort of most remembered for, and maybe it's an early warning about what the limits of special prosecutors are, is that what it's most remembered for is that it was one of Grant's close associates, and most people would say he himself was not corrupt, but he was extremely loyal to the people that were around him, and so he actually testified on behalf of this gentleman that was sort of at the center of the case, and the jury didn't convict. And so it's a sort of early lesson about presidential prerogative and the way in which the president can interfere with special prosecutors in ways that I think we don't think about regularly.
And again, this is sort of the very beginnings of federal jurisprudence in some ways. So now you've got somebody, we'll talk about the individual involved here, who has to kind of create this office out of whole cloth. We've got a body of law. We know how to prosecute that. But now you're telling me I have to do it outside the system, then bring it back in the system. So what were some of the challenges?
And then I got to come up against the president
of the
United States.
And then the president's going to be. It's a political yeah. process
yeah.
in the end anyway.
So I think, you know, one of the ironies of the special prosecutors or the use of them is the reason we get them is we want to take politics
right.
out of the investigation. But what my research shows is that you really can't do that. And especially if it's close to the president or the president himself. It's extraordinarily difficult to do that, and you've got the sort of institutional base of the presidency is much stronger, certainly at that time, than was a special prosecutor.
And I know there's a big debate about this today, but the framers had some of this in mind when they came up with the whole impeachment process, wanting to keep the president out of, because it was clear to somebody that you could constantly be accusing the president of a crime, and if you happen to be an opponent of the president, you could keep the president tangled up in legal proceedings for a long time. So wasn't that part of the reason we have a special impeachment process? Because you could just arrest the president and send the president to jail. You wouldn't have to go through all that congressional rigmarole, right? So the framers recognized that this was a special office that needed, one way or another, even if this president was could be prosecuted as a criminal, we need a special process because of the politics involved.
Yeah, I think that's true. There is disagreement among legal historians about sort of how much the framers thought all that through. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we look back and sort of ascribe to mm-hmm. them motives that maybe they didn't have. But if you just do a sort of literal reading of the text in terms of the impeachment process, it does imply that impeachment would happen first and prosecution second, because it says like after a semicolon. Mm-hmm. And semicolons, as I tell my students, are important. After that, it says that impeachment does not mean that you cannot be prosecuted, right? But there are people who argue that the other sort of guiding principle of the founding fathers was that no one is above the law, right. And that includes right. the president. And so that's the tension, right? That's the dilemma, if Congress refuses to follow the constitutional process of impeachment, does that mean the president is above the law?
Right.
That's another principle we don't like to think is true.
So let's talk about some more of these scandals and when special prosecutors were engaged. The 1820s, the Teapot Dome scandal.
1920s.
Yeah. Yeah,
right, the Teapot Dome scandal. An interesting case, because in that case you had two special prosecutors appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress, and one was a Republican and one was a Democrat, and the whole sort of idea was, that this would be the way that you ensured right. politics didn't come into it, is that they had to agree on sort of
to tell us how that developed. And we've actually should remind us what the scandal, this is an oil scandal, right?
Yeah, and it had to do with the oil reserves
selling the oil reserves.
And so. the Secretary of the Interior, who oversees those reserves, sort of selling them, I think it was to Standard Oil. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, Albert Fall, who was the Interior Secretary, was successfully prosecuted for taking a bribe, but the Standard Oil people were not successfully prosecuted for offering a bribe.
See, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. It's right there in the text, but no, we can't prosecute them. So now here's the one. So I knew about Teapot Dome and I knew about the whiskey scandal, but now Harry Truman's tax scandal. This one I had no idea until we started investigating this. Tell us about Harry Truman.
Well, and I think you pointed out maybe earlier that it's maybe we don't know about it as much because he was on his way out, and so nobody pursued
cared.
It too far along the route. But it involved tax fixing in the tax division of the Justice Department and with some cooperation with some people in the IRS. And because it involved the Department of Justice, the view was that we should have a special prosecutor. I mean, I think the places where you almost always get them are as if the Department of Justice is implicated and mm-hmm. if the president is implicated. And so the special prosecutor was brought in, and he decided that rather than just focusing on the individuals that were accused of violating of committing the crimes,
right.
that it would be a good thing if the whole sort of top three levels of government all filled out this lengthy survey on all of their finances and all these kinds of things. So this is like one of those early examples of saying, runaway special prosecutor. And
right.
so there was a lot of pushback to those requests, and so the attorney general fired the special prosecutor, and then of course that created, as you might imagine, some backlash as well, and then Truman fired his attorney general.
And this is interesting because it does bring us into the modern age and some of the politics around the question of appointing and then perhaps relieving the special prosecutor. In this case, you had an attorney general who had quite a personality. The fact is we've developed by this time a far more robust bureaucracy for collecting taxes. That had to be done during World War II. We sort of had taxes on the books, but it was a little bit helter-skelter. Now we've got many more people involved in collecting taxes, which means many more people who can figure out ways to collect bribes, right? Because, you owe a lot of money, but for $100, I think I can fix it for you. And that's what was happening at these low levels. The attorney general, who had attracted a lot of attention, now we're starting to look up the chain and we're wondering if he's involved. What's interesting is we bring in a prosecutor who is clean as a whistle, knows the law, but doesn't know Washington.
Right. That would be a good way to describe him. And that became a problem in later special right. prosecutor investigations, as well as this sort of somebody who's clean as a whistle. And for a while there, it was like federal judges, because the assumption was a federal judge was incorruptible. But they don't necessarily just not know Washington. They don't necessarily know prosecutorial practice either. which became a criticism.
It is fascinating to think about the fact that there is no way to escape the politics of this, right? You want to make it look clean. We're bringing in somebody from the outside. Aren't you glad they don't know politics? No, because they can't succeed. And even the people who wanted this thing prosecuted said, you're rubbing us all the wrong way. In the end, I think part of it was the fact that Truman was a lame duck when all this was happening, but also he fired this prosecutor who is attracting all the attention, which for a lot of people was the head they wanted, right?
Yeah.
So now this brings us to Watergate, where the special prosecutor really comes into the limelight, where a president fires the special prosecutor, thinks he's going to get away with murder, and doesn't turn out that way.
Yeah. No. In fact, I mean, most people would point to the Saturday Night Massacre when Archibald Cox was fired, and then the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General both refused to fire him, and so it actually fell to Robert Bork, who was the Solicitor General at the time. As sort of the reason we got an independent counsel statute, for sure, but also as sort of the ultimate lesson of why you can't let the Attorney General or the President appoint the independent counsel.
Because they did in this case, if you remember, the man who ultimately gets appointed to this is Leon Jaworski, right? And what Nixon knows is, Nixon knows he's in for a political hellstorm when he fires Archibald Cox. So if we can find somebody who has great credential and bona fides, who appears to be an honest broker to the American public, maybe we can get away with this. Leon Jaworski, conservative Democrat from Texas. They think they've got their man.
Yeah, and they were wrong.
They were wrong because he prosecuted. Is there any sense that people like Archibald Cox and Leon Jaworski were looking back at the history of special prosecutors, or was Watergate so unique that they were having to write the story from scratch?
I mean, I think it was unique in the sense that the sitting president was the focus. Right, because Truman was not implicated. Coolidge was president. I mean, it was Warren G. Harding was the one who was sort of the president when the Teapot Dome scandal took place, when the bribes took place, but he was dead. Right. And Coolidge was president. So Nixon's really the first one where the focus is on something the president did wrong. And so I think in that sense, some historians have argued that the worst thing he did was fire Archibald Cox, because Archibald Cox, a constitutional law professor, had like way more respect for sort of the institution of the presidency and was being much more cautious, according to the people on his staff, than Jaworski, who came in and felt like he had something to prove because Congress didn't trust him, right? Because he was like the head of Democrats for Nixon or something like that in 1968. So he felt like his reputation was at stake, and so he fought much harder.
But remind us of the effect in the relationship, because again, there is a process for removing the president from office if you think there's been malfeasance, and that is a congressional. It's a deliberately political process. We start in the House, where the indictment will take place. We call it an impeachment. There will be a trial in the Senate, and then the Senate will decide to remove or not. And then there's a special prosecutor, which is looking at bringing criminal charges. So Jaworski, what does he do, and how does that lead to impeachment? What's the relationship between what Jaworski did and what the House ultimately did, which was to impeach a sitting president?
Yeah, and then that's also something sort of in some ways unique about what was going on, is that you had the congressional investigations, and then you had the criminal investigations. And initially, the criminal investigations were really looking at something much smaller, right? It's the break-in in Watergate, and then it starts to come out that there's more going on at the higher levels, but it's fairly late in the game before they realize Nixon was directing all of that. So I think when the criminal investigation started, it was really more because the Attorney General at the time, Richard Kleindienst, was sort of reporting to the White House, and then when that came out, he was fired, and then you got a new attorney general who then said, I'll appoint a special prosecutor to reassure people. But they still didn't realize it reached the president.
Right.
You had the Congress doing investigations into Watergate, and then, stuff comes out, and then it gets closer and closer to the White House. And then the cover-up is really ultimately what does
them in.
That's
when you start really breaking laws. Like somebody else might have broken in, and they are charged with a burglary, but when you start lying about it, all of a sudden we've got a crime that we can charge to the president. So let's take a look at two of the very lengthy investigations. Iran-Contra in the 80s, Ronald Reagan at the center of that, Whitewater in the 90s with Bill Clinton.
Right. So both of those much longer investigations, the Independent Counsel investigation for Iran-Contra took 7 years, and the Whitewater was 5 or 6 years, right? So the criticism of Walsh that, Mueller, that it's taking him...
Right.
2 years to get as far as he got is really sort of silly in the comparison of things. But both involved the president. I think most people would agree that in both situations it was appropriate to have a special prosecutor. But in both cases they were criticized, and ultimately I think to some, either specifically or by implication, their credibility was undermined because of the amount of time the investigation mm-hmm. took, and the way in which the president's surrogates used those kinds of issues. How much is this costing? How much time is it taking? They're prosecuting for things not what their original charge was to look into this, and now they're prosecuting for lying to Congress or lying to the grand jury. That all happened, and so we've seen that happen this time around too, but what's different is that it was the president's surrogates doing it, or it was like George H.W. Bush late in the process doing it. And here you have the president doing it by tweet.
So let's talk about this now, the Mueller investigation. First of all, as you watch the way that investigation took place, is it obvious to you, or were there any signs that Robert Mueller was taking notes from these historical precedents when he took on this job?
Yeah, I think not just Mueller, but possibly Congress as well. So, for example, I think the lesson of Iran-Contra was don't let the congressional investigation take precedence over the criminal investigation, because in that case, they immunized Oliver North and John Poindexter to get their testimony public. And in the mm-hmm. end, even though the special prosecutor successfully prosecuted them for crimes, they got thrown out on appeal because they couldn't prove that they hadn't been tainted by the immunized testimony, right? So the lesson was, do not immunize anybody who might actually be implicated. And I think Congress knew that. I mean, I'm not even sure that, I don't think there was ever any conversation between the independent counsel and Congress on that. I just think the lesson was, don't do that if there's people that are prosecutable.
So, and again, it is an odd kind of parallel track if you're on both at once. Now Congress is considering the possibility of impeachment. Why do both? I mean, to some extent, if you're going to prosecute, to do a criminal prosecution, and you know the standard is going to be pretty high because you got to knock out the sitting president, why not just make it a political process
if the two can't talk to themselves?
The
purpose is not to knock out a sitting president, right? The purpose is to have an impartial investigation to decide whether or not the president has done anything wrong.
Not if they actually take up the... that's because it's a political process. You're not going to do it if you're not trying to knock him out.
Right.
And that's the point. Whereas a prosecutor does take a very different... I mean, I think that's the point, is that you have a deliberately political process in impeachment.
Yes, and in congressional... I mean, the problem is Congress has different interests...
Right.
Institutional interests, not just political interests, than does a prosecutor. Congress's responsibility is to investigate in order to decide whether there's a need for legislation, and also to investigate in order to bring public light to a problem or to an issue, right? So their interests are getting everything out there. And the special prosecutor's interests, I mean, prosecutors say, we let our indictment speak, and if we don't indict, we're not speaking. Right, and Robert Mueller has been the perfect example of that principle.
So can they?
Which was one of the criticisms of him, is that he held press conferences all the time, was always talking to the press, and so I think what Mueller took from that is don't be Ken Starr.
Don't talk to the press. Katie Herriger is a professor in the Department of Politics and International Affairs at Wake Forest University. Katie, thank you so much for talking with us. Just ahead, a documentary that digs into Greensboro's historic R&B scene. We'll talk about that, but first, the music of Barefoot Modern.
Step right up and come on down. Don't you hide in the shadows. Dive on in, the water's warm, but it ain't safe or it's shallow. The breath of life, I'm talking about the one that I gave you. Where were you when we were all sad to leave? But I'm not allowed to. Ooh, won't you tell me? Ooh. how'd you get so